Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I think nearly everybody in the USA knows by now that Juneteenth is Black Liberation Day, the racial mirror image of July 4th. Probably the last ignoramus to be informed has been Donald Trump. This 2020 Juneteenth might well be the most significant since the last slaves in Texas were told they were free on tomorrow's date, 155 years ago, on June 19, 1865. Which might be why Donald Trump callously attempted to usurp it with a rally after all the well-deserved humiliation he has suffered these past few weeks with the Black Lives Matter revolt against a black man being murdered by police, and the overwhelming white co-fraternity with fellow citizen blacks in equal anger and disgust at police brutality and racism. Trump pleaded ignorance of Juneteenth and moved his rally to 20 June the next day, but still in a city, Tulsa, the site of the most gruesome medieval-style massacre of American blacks by whites. But at a price for ardent Trumpians who are dictated to attend the rally by signing a no-fault clause if their attendance goes viral with virus. Perhaps Napoleon Bonaparte Trump is about to meet his own Waterloo, the original date of which is today, 205 years ago, on June 18, 1815, 40 years and one day earlier than Juneteenth. I would like to start the program with something I wrote, Images of Dark, Angry Shadows. I start with a quote by Harriet Tubman. There was one or two things I had a right to, liberty or death. If I could not have one, I would have the other. For no man should take me alive. I should fight for my liberty as long as my strength lasted. Harriet Tubman led more than 300 slaves to freedom following the drinking gourd, the North Star. Her portrait on the U.S. $20 bill has been delayed indefinitely by Donald Trump. How appropriately awesome might it be if the counterfeit $20 bill that caused George Floyd to be murdered by police was engraved with Tubman's portrait? Racism is the scourge of American democracy, and slavery was its hellspawn. American history is taught from a decidedly white perspective, which is only a portion of our history. And without integrating it with Black American history, it is a lie that perpetuates the gross, brutal evil of slave-spawned racism that underlies and embitters our truly pluralistic history. White and Black Americans cannot separate our history from the long, cruel centuries of racial enslavement. To be Black was to be a slave, period. Without Black slavery from Africa, much of the Western Hemisphere would not have been converted to an enclave of European civilization. African Blacks and European whites were parallel colonizers of the Americas, and together they built the civilizations that ousted the originals and currently prevails in both continents. The primary difference is that Black immigration was a forced migration. Millions of Blacks were brought in chains from Africa for 400 years. Slavery evolved in the Americas as the result of the need for abundant cheap labor. The traffic in violently captured slaves from raided villages all over Africa was itself the most profitable international trade in history. Entire industries were built on the commerce in human slaves. As cruel and as inhumane as such human trafficking was, which induced an opaqueness to the torment inflicted by the slave trade, the extent and profitability of slavery built cities and helped raise the capital that, ironically, financed the start of the Industrial Revolution in England. Roundaboutly, much of Africa was emptied to provide slaves for overseas European colonies, while most of Africa was colonized by Europeans. History remains mute about how many millions of Black Africans were murdered in their villages during four centuries of slave raids. It is estimated, however, that about one-third of those captured died en route to the coasts or while imprisoned awaiting embarkation aboard slave ships. Another third died aboard ships in which they were chained and stacked like cords of wood in filthy, overcrowded holds, or afterward died during the seasoning process of slavery, worked to death in stifling climates, mortally whipped or beaten if they were slow to obey or attempted to escape. a much more grisly death on the high seas occurred to countless others after the slave trade was finally declared illegal at the end of the 18th century, but not slavery itself, which made the now illicit trade in slaves incredibly more profitable. When capture was imminent to a slave ship, black men, women, and children were thrown overboard, chained together, to drown in the ocean. As mentioned previously, slavery in North America, in particular, has from its inception been identified with being black. The mere fact of being black was to be a slave, without human rights of any sort, without rights to marriage, children, or the product of their work. Black children were regarded only as prospective slaves and could be sold away from their families at any time for any reason. Slavery was considered perpetual. Chances of working toward freedom were impossibly rare. Wherever there were slaves, there was a slave society, not merely for blacks, but for whites also. Blacks and whites were bound together in cruel and bitter acrimony, but also in a complex, warped relationship that could not express itself without reference to each other. It was a class relativism, increasingly defined as a racial differentiation. North American Southern society in particular was enclosed and closed off by the slave system. To quote C. Van Woodward, author of the classic The Strange Career of Jim Crow, "The ironic thing about these two great hyphenate minorities, Southern American and Afro-Americans, confronting each other on their native soil for 3.5 centuries, is the degree to which they have shaped each other's destiny, determined each other's isolation, shared and molded a common culture. It is, in fact, impossible to imagine the one without the other, and quite futile to try." And that was C. Van Woodward. The antebellum South was haunted by its guilt and fear of slavery. Enslaving blacks was patently justified through claims that it was God's intent that whites were superior to blacks, that slavery civilized primitive African blacks and elevated them above their former status as jungle savages. The suasion that, in essence, whites were carrying out God's law was by making useful slaves and good Christians out of pagan black-skinned inferiors. In reality, however, southern plantations in particular were raw battlefields where slaves fought masters for physical and psychological survival. Although they were literally unlettered, outnumbered, and unarmed, black slaves struggled in as many ways as they were able to preserve their humanity against virtually inhuman odds. Southern whites bitterly resisted acknowledging the humanity of their black slaves, which was contradictory to their claim of God's edict to Christianize them. Underlying their pious justification was a terror of the system they had fabricated. The culture of the antebellum South was continually in dread of slave insurrection, and any outbreak was savagely suppressed. In a very real juxtaposed intuition of horror, an essential motive for perpetuating slavery was the dread of reprisal once it was abolished. Most northern whites also considered themselves racially superior to blacks, slave or free, and the desire to eradicate slavery had more to do with its interference with paid labor than with human rights. Even a majority of the northern white abolitionists who had risked imprisonment and eventual... Even a majority of the northern white abolitionists who had risked imprisonment and even their lives providing underground systems of escape for runaway slaves felt that blacks should dwell apart from whites. A back to Africa movement was popular, if not quite practical, among northern anti-slave sympathizers. The American-inspired African colony of freed slaves was a golden beacon, however compromised its reality. Yet ultimately, however intense the racial or economic dialectic regarding slavery, and perhaps the climate of burgeoning industrialism allowed for it, the most important reason for the abolition of slavery was the moral one. The idea of the inherent value of an individual outlasted slavery and was the chief source of its undoing. The fight for independence that characterized the American Revolution did not include liberty for slaves, and that oversight caused the Civil War 80 years later. White supremacist groups grew out of the South's defeat in the Civil War and exacted brutal revenge against the freed slaves, who were terrorized and murdered with fire and rope. The most dominant, ruthless, and unrelenting were the Knight Riders of the Ku Klux Klan and their propensity for resurrection. Lynchings of blacks, especially males, but also women, were commonplace after the Civil War and lasted until the seventh decade of the 20th century. Two black men found mysteriously hanging from California trees last week might very well have been lynched in retaliation for the nationwide protest against police brutality and murder of blacks they accost, such as George Floyd. Although the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s dramatized and somewhat tepidly improved black prospects, the pervasive racism that saturates American society and dominates the Trump presidency in particular continues to strip away nearly every advance toward black equality in the United States. Slaves or free, the arduous, tragic, and unequal role of black Americans in building and defending the nation has always been devalued and generally ignored. Yet the black struggle for civic, social, and political equality, especially in the last generation, has been the most inspiring and closest to the revolution of the Enlightenment that gave birth to the USA than any other. Racism will only end when children of every race are taught early that the color of skin is far less than the quality of hearts and minds and the spirit of soul. That will not be easy and has never been, which is manifestly obvious. No less than the educational system of the USA must be revisioned to reflect the common struggle of both black and white and every other race to build and survive in this country, not to mention all of terra not so firma in general. Muhammad Ali spoke directly to parochial racism when he sacrificed his world champ boxing title by refusing to be inducted into the U.S. Armed Forces in 1967, not only famously saying that he did not want to kill Viet Cong, but also that the military draft was about, quote, white people sending black people to fight yellow people to protect the country they stole from red people, unquote. And the martyred Malcolm X, I believe that there will ultimately be a clash between the oppressed and those who do the oppressing. I believe there will be a clash between those who want freedom, justice, and equality for everyone, and those who want to continue the system of exploitation. I believe there will be that kind of clash, but I don't think it will be based on the color of the skin. And that was Malcolm X. Rainbow America has marched in Malcolm X's shadow these past few weeks. And now, something I read on this program a couple of years back, but I think is really poignant for today's program, by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, Strange Fruit. News traveled fast in 1939 after she debuted the song. Released as a single, the song eventually sold 1 million copies and became her signature song, even as most radio stations in America refused to play it. The song was Strange Fruit, and the singer was Billie Holiday, considered one of the best jazz vocalists of all time. Billie referred to Strange Fruit as her personal protest against lynching and was often harassed for singing it. Close friends said that singing that song made her sick and upset after all she had seen and experienced as a black woman. Consider the lyrics. Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh, and the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for a tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter crop. Strange Fruit, written by Abel Meeropol, son of Jewish immigrants, proved to be a powerful example of protest art that helped galvanize the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, speaking to millions of black and white Americans yearning for a more just civil society. Billie Holiday's haunting rendition conjured America's horrific legacy of lynching, where white mobs tortured and murdered at least 3,500 black men, women, and children for a variety of supposed offenses, including insulting whites, interracial sex, and other generally unproven crimes. Whole families came to witness lynchings, and merriment, food, whiskey, and flags abounded. Typifying the grotesque excess of spectacle, lynching was the lynching of 17-year-old African-American farmhand Jesse Washington in Waco, Texas, on May 15, 1916. After a jury deliberated just 4 minutes, a mob dragged Washington from his cell and hanged him before 10,000 people on the grounds of City Hall, as the mayor and chief of police watched from a window above. That kind of festivity obscured the sinister murder and dulled the ritual's true function, reestablishing and maintaining the power of whites over blacks in post-slavery America. The ugliness of lynching, which persisted from Reconstruction through the mid-1960s and beyond, is difficult for white and Afro-Americans to face after decades of white silence and faded memories. But who can forget the brutal slaying of 14-year-old Emmett Till on August 28, 1955, in Money, Mississippi? At his Chicago funeral, his mother, Mamie Till, insisted that thousands of mourners view Emmett in an open casket. The Till murder was instrumental in advancing the plea for civil rights for black Americans. Lynching is the execution, most often by hanging, of a man, woman, or child by a lawless crowd or mob, without due process. Black Americans were sometimes burned alive, shot, drowned, beaten, or otherwise murdered by white mobs. The number of lynchings in America varies depending on the time frame and source of lynching reports. But according to NAACP records, there were 4,743 lynchings in the United States between 1882 and 1968, with 73% involving black Americans. Some 1,297 white people, 27%, were lynched for helping blacks, opposing lynching, or for domestic crimes like cattle rustling. According to Richard M. Perloff, professor of communication at Cleveland State University, there are four principal characteristics of lynching: a hatred of blacks, victims innocent of any crime, law enforcement looking the other way, and making an example of the alleged violator. An estimated 79% of lynchings happened in the South, led by Mississippi with 581 lynchings. Most lynchings that occurred in the West were of whites accused of murder or cattle theft. Race riots broke out in 1919 in 26 cities, including Chicago and Washington, D.C. White mobs lynched at least 76 African Americans, 12 of them U.S. soldiers, perhaps World War I veterans. Lynching did not end in 1968, as statistics may imply. The last lynching, a one-hour special on race in America, occurred on October 13, 2008. Veteran broadcast journalist Ted Koppel focused on a 1981 lynching of 19-year-old Michael Donald in Mobile, Alabama, by two members of the Ku Klux Klan. Koppel claimed that lynchings are a form of terrorism, and the particular purpose was to say to Afro-Americans that you will never vote or be part of the political process in this country. And if you think you will move in that direction, there will be terrible consequences. And that was Ted Koppel. Afro-American James Byrd was murdered by three white men in Jasper, Texas on June 7, 1998. One perpetrator was executed, another sentenced to execution, and the other Afro-American James Byrd was murdered by three white men in Jasper, Texas on June 7, 1998. One perpetrator was executed, another sentenced to execution, and the other received a life sentence. So there was some justice of sorts, subsequent to one of the most vicious racial crimes in American history. Just 1 year later, on October 6, 1999, a gay 19-year-old white man Matthew Shepard, was brutally murdered in Laramie, Wyoming. Shepard stood just 5 feet 2 inches tall. There have been belated and somewhat reluctant efforts to acknowledge and apologize for the killing of thousands of innocent Americans. After noting that nearly 200 anti-lynching bills had been introduced and defeated in Congress during the first half of the 20th century, the U.S. Senate on June 13, 2005, finally approved a resolution apologizing for its failure to enact federal anti-lynching legislation. That was the first time the Senate had apologized, after numerous Senate filibusters blocked legislation 3 times in the 20th century, and there was no roll call, only a voice vote from the few senators on the floor. After the August 9, 2017 protest event in Charlottesville, Virginia, President Donald Trump issued remarks that appeared to condone the activities of white supremacists. Trump continues to advocate violence directed at minorities and women. But there remains hope. The Legacy Museum and National Memorial for Peace and Justice, dedicated to the victims of white supremacy, opened on April 26, 2018. The 6-acre site details the harrowing magnitude of lynchings and provides a jarring expression of confidence in the possibility of change. Yet it remains evident that American history is heavy with racism. It's immediate, it's everywhere, it's visible, it's violent, and it's dramatic. Sadly, many Americans take lightly the horror and injustice of lynchings, as did an Oakhurst, California high school principal who allowed 2 teenagers wearing Ku Klux Klan costumes to pretend lynch another boy wearing blackface at a Halloween party on October 31, 1993. Pathetic. Ida B. Wells, an African-American journalist and activist who led an anti-lynching crusade in the 1890s, concluded, "Our country's national crime is lynching. It is not the creature of an hour, the sudden outburst of uncontrolled fury, or the unspeakable brutality of an insane mob." And that was Ida B. Wells. While we have acknowledged our culpability, we need to do more to promote equal justice for all. We need to heed the advice of Abraham Lincoln, who in his 1861 inaugural address urged Americans to be imbued by the better angels of our nature. Sherilyn A. Eiffel, author of On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, has proposed a number of local reparation initiatives. She suggests public apologies, expunging the records of or issuing pardons to black lynching victims accused of or convicted of crimes they did not commit. In addition, Eiffel suggests the creation of monuments or commemorative public spaces in the community, placing gravestones on unmarked burial sites of lynching victims, mandatory school programs on the local history of lynching, reopening criminal investigations into lynchings, financial compensation for lynching victims' descendants, and for those whose family homes or businesses were destroyed in the aftermath of lynching, and institutional reform focused on the legal system and the media. A tall order indeed. But it seems clear that we have the opportunity to confront 20th century racial violence and begin a long overdue process of truth-telling and reconciliation. Addressing a Cornell University graduating class on October 15, 1962, Martin Luther King Jr. quipped, "It may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can stop him from lynching me." And I think that's pretty important. And that was Dr. Robert Brake, Strange Fruit. He lives in Ocean Park, Washington. He is a frequent contributor to this program and writes for the Chinook Observer. I conclude today's program with another famous example of black liberation, the defeat of white apartheid in South Africa, which was legally enforced by a minority vote in South Africa's white assembly, representing only 20% of the population, on June 13, 1950, but which had been in practice for a long beforehand, just given so-called legal sanctity. And I wrote it, and I call it Apartheid Means Slavery. I shall start with a quote from The Progressive from 1985. "The South African government is an insult to humanity and deserves the contempt of all civilized beings." The irresistible press of history extinguished the apartheid government of white South Africa, which spent most of the 20th century resisting it with a system of slavery that, with brief but periodic exceptions, became repulsive to civilization in the 19th century. White South Africa had imposed itself too long on the world and on its captive people, and finally history finished it off, although the trauma apartheid inflicted will persist for quite some time. White South Africa was itself an anachronism, a lost colony left behind and isolated by the crumbling empires of Europe. It was a final vestige of a colonial system that began five centuries ago, when Europe started its surge across the planet. Much of Africa was emptied to provide slaves for European colonies in the Western Hemisphere, and most of Africa itself was colonized by European nations. For centuries, Africans who were not sent across the oceans as slaves were enslaved at home. The two great wars of the 20th century devastated European power and broke up the empires into independent states, most of which reverted to some form of home rule. The African colonies collapsed in the same manner until, almost alone on the continent and in the world, the white-dominated government of South Africa remained. From the start, the draconian concept of apartheid, which means separation, was white South Africa's defense against cultural extinction, a final entrenchment by an embattled political system struggling to survive a while longer. The entire brutal state apparatus that was designed to deny any political identity or power to the black majority, 70% of the population, could only be a stall against the inevitable tide of their disquiet and served as a final laceration that ensured their rise to crush it. The systematic arrests and murders of emerging black leaders spawned the appearance of others. The detention, torture, and killing of children to stifle newer generations of insurgents only guaranteed their growth. Each step to maintain the regime was a greater atrocity that created a proportionate response. By the time reforms were offered to appease revolt, they were long past the needs or desires of those in revolt, and most of the time too late to stop them. Once the insurgents' power was recognized by acts of reform, they were too powerful to resist. All of the terrible, crippling pain, fear, and hatred that had been stifled and stored up for so long seemed perpetually prone to explode into rage, and the death dance between oppressor and oppressed speeded up ruthlessness and reaction, evolving inexorably toward denouement. Survival was the major object of apartheid, and the question why white South Africa would want to survive was as irrelevant as why any organism should wish to endure. White South Africa could not afford to compromise, or its visceral history would be lost. Its white culture, however much it repulsed most of the rest of the world, deceived itself that it was vital and historically legitimate. That its memory would undoubtedly be a legacy of intolerance and contempt was not necessarily apparent to itself. Nations, like persons, are not greatly noted for honest self-appraisal. The real fear was that after white rule was dismantled, genocide would be enacted against whites. There also was apprehension that the antipathy that had developed between the black factions and between them and blacks who worked for whites might erupt into a civil war or an immense pogrom. A native tyranny was harsh and ruthless, as white rule was a great anxiety as well. History was a disquieting precedent. Slow, painful evolution toward political freedom was the hope, but the tendency of regimes released from foreign domination has usually been in the opposite direction. The people of Africa have not fared especially well under the home rules that replaced European dominance, but the possibility of positive change is at least within their own borders. In the end, the response of most of the world to the white South African apartheid government was critical and supportive of the revolts of the black masses. But that had been a long time coming. The U.S. government had conducted itself shamefully during the Cold War years, and so also had the Soviet Union up until its own dissolution. Each in its own manner subverted or openly enforced its will upon vast populations throughout the world, and each engaged in the subversion of weaker governments. Each condemned the deplorable regimes in alliance with the other and defended the same ruthlessness of its own allies. As in most civil wars that occurred since World War II, the struggle in South Africa was a miniature Cold War. for a long time rejected by the United States, South Africa's Black Liberation Movement turned to the Soviet Union for weapons and equipment. The U.S. failed to realize that by siding with oppressive regimes, it pushed the oppressed into the arms of the USSR. When Moscow helped the insurgents, the U.S. claimed Soviet aid as an excuse to overtly or clandestinely furnish armaments to the ruling status quo to destroy the revolt while exaggerating its threat to U.S. interests. This is what occurred in South Africa for almost half a century. And as it was with all superpower disputes during the Cold War, the escalating trouble in South Africa threatened to be an incipient cause of nuclear war. The way it ended was that the white regime in South Africa disappeared as a final European enclave in the Third World.